heart.
Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. On this week's edition, Michigan Democratic Party Chair Lavora Barnes gives odds on four congressional races as she breaks down last week's convention. Darcy McConnell from the Reproductive Freedom for All campaign pushes back on claims the constitutional amendment is too expansive and extreme to be adopted by voters. A Democratic State House candidate talks about why Bill G. Schuette isn't a slam dunk in November. The MERS team breaks down Republican gubernatorial candidate Tudor Dixon's running mate pick, both the selection of Shane Hernandez and the timing of the announcement. And how serious is John James' carpetbagger issue in Michigan's 10th district? Now here's MERS News editor Kyle Malin with John Roerink and Samantha Schreiber.
The news you get just part.
Hugh Mark Bayshore. Samantha and John, the lieutenant governor pick has been chosen by Tudor Dixon. Whether that's the one the Republican convention will stick with, we're going to have to find out later. But let's talk about the pick itself. John, Shane Hernandez, former appropriations chair of the Michigan House, what did you think?
Well, he covers the requirement that she have somebody on her ticket that has legislative experience. That's sort of in the vein of John Cherry for Jennifer Granholm and Brian Kelly for Rick Snyder. So he kind of fits in those things. What I'm a little curious to see what happens with Garrett Saldana's decision he's expected to make this morning or later today is whether he sees an avenue here. Because if you look at sort of the party the way it is today, you know, I think you can make an argument that Hernandez was on the wrong side of Trump. He's kind of, it could be pigeonholed as a, you know, as a traditional Republican in a lot of ways, that Tudor Dixon, you know, capitulated to the mainstream side of the party by picking him. The delegate selection or the group of delegates we have this weekend coming together are probably in a mood where if there was a serious effort, it could actually have some traction to supplant him with somebody else.
The thing I liked about Shane Hernandez is that you can't really accuse him of being a rhino. I mean, you can't. Can you really look at yourself straight in the face and say, Shane Hernandez, who is one of the most conservative members of the state house, is a rhino? I just don't know how you do that.
I don't think you can do it by just arguing, look, he was a member of the House. Look, he ran the Appropriations Committee. He's been absorbed by Lansing already. He was the kind of pick that the mainstream Republicans would have wanted her to make. There you go. That's all you need to say, right?
You know, it's definitely kind of funny because I was covering the Oakland County Circuit Court decision on Friday, and a bunch of us reporters were like waiting for the court door to open, and we're like, oh, who's it going to be? Who's it going to be? And I made a joke. I'm like, I think it's going to be a sophisticated businessman in a really nice suit from Southeast Michigan.
That's an idea.
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely kind of my theory. Well, for me, I started my internship here. And at this time, this was when Shane Hernandez was in that congressional primary with Lisa McClain. So that was kind of my last memory from him. So it was interesting to see kind of some of the, you know, Democrats like, oh, it's going to be Ryan Kelly, you know, just kind of doing that little evil claw hand gesture, you know, making their little gifts on social media.
Oh, right.
And then when Shane Hernandez was announced, a lot of them who have just kind of entered the conversation in the last 2 years, they're like, wait, who's Shane Hernandez? And I think that's something to keep in mind of. Like, there are a lot of new people that have entered the party, that have entered the conversation in the last year, the last 2 years. And, you know, for a lot of those newcomers, he's still a new name.
See, I like the pick of Shane Hernandez. I thought it was a good pick. Because if you looked at some of the other people that were being considered, I think that it would have been easier to peg them as being a rhino. Shane Hernandez comes from Tea Party roots. I mean, that's where he came from. He was a Tea Party activist, a leader in Port Huron before he decided to even run for the state house. And when he was at the state house, he had a lot of respect among his caucus members. You just don't become a probst chair for nothing. And had he wanted to be speaker, you have to wonder how he would have done. My understanding is he would have done very well. Him and Jason Wentworth would have had to strike some kind of deal if there was going to be a race, because it would not have been Jason Wentworth in a slam dunk, I can tell you that. Shane Hernandez earns people's respect, and I think he's Him going out there right now is I think a plus for Tudor Dixon in trying to, I guess, galvanize the hardcore right conservative movement. As far as independent voters, I don't know what he does as far as bringing those in, but I get the impression that she's not worried about that right now. She's just trying to get through convention.
Talk a little bit, Kyle, though, about the mechanics of this pick, and you mentioned some things earlier that suggested it was made very, very late in the cycle.
Yeah. So the Republican Party had a 5 p.m. deadline by which time Tudor Dixon had to make a decision, and she went right up against that deadline. Because if you think about it, guys, 5 o'clock on a Friday is usually when you dump your bad news because you're going into a weekend. The reporters are checking out for the weekend. Nobody really wants to work any later than that. So you dump your bad news so it doesn't get as covered as well. And so then, you know, Saturday when the readers, or the viewers or whatever are checking in, they're not going to be paying attention as much. You want to announce your good news somewhere in the middle of the week. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, preferably in the morning. And so you get as much news cycle and as much bounce as it is possible. By announcing this at Friday afternoon, this tells me that they didn't make this decision until the absolute last minute. And had there not been a 5 o'clock deadline for the Republican Party, we still might not have a Tudor Dixon announcement. So I don't know if they had problems making a decision, if they had problems finding people willing to do it, but to come out with the announcement when they did, and then have a video immediately afterwards where it's Tudor and Shane Hernandez, and it looks like it's the first time they'd ever met each other. I think the rollout could have been a lot better, John.
No, well, I mean, I think something that I've especially been kind of reporting on is this, you know, potential for Governor Whitmer to bury Tudor Dixon in her lack of name ID. And I especially saw that at the Democratic convention. I didn't hear Tudor Dixon's name dropped once. She's continuously being referred to as either the alternative option or the conspiracy
theorist.
You mean
during convention?
Yeah.
You hardly heard her name?
Hardly heard her name.
Oh. And so this was an opportunity for lieutenant governor where she could have boosted her name ID.
Yeah, well, I mean, here's like the thing too. So, I mean, you think about back when Governor Whitmer had announced her pick with Garland Gilchrist. I mean, they had a little bit of a rally, and you know, Garland Gilchrist and Whitmer had this immediate image of, you know, look at us, we're best friends, and we're taking on the city, and we're taking on the state. And then, you know, for this, it was kind of like a Twitter video that unless you were immediately following Tudor Dixon, you would have to go out and search if you weren't. So, I mean, that brings me to my question to you and John. I mean, is Shane Hernandez going to help with this issue of the lack of name ID?
Well, that's a great point, because when Gretchen Whitmer picked Garland Gilchrist 4 years ago, they went over in Lansing. They went a couple streets down, the street that overlooks the Capitol, and it was a nice visual. And there was a big stage, and we had all the reporters there, and Garland was available for some press, and he did one-on-ones later, and it was a big event, and there was no big event here. They showed up together at the Dream Cruise, and a couple papers and maybe some TV stations caught them there as part of, oh, here's some great cars that are going by too.
But you will remember, though, when Garland Gilchrist was announced, there were a lot of questions around Lansing. I mean, I'm talking about the people that work in and around the system. Who's Garland Gilchrist? Right. They don't have that with Shane Hernandez. They know who this guy is. So there's from that perspective, you know, if you want to contrast the two, you got to point that out too. So
yeah, but see, the folks in Lansing though knew Gretchen Whitmer, so the fact they didn't know Garland Gilchrist was, yeah, that's okay. We still know Gretchen. Here they know Shane, but they really don't know Tudor. So in that respect, I think the folks here in Lansing are probably happier that it's Shane Hernandez because it's somebody they've worked with, even if they didn't work with him, you know, as well as they did somebody else. At least they know him, as opposed to the person Sam said at the beginning here, which is somebody in a suit and a successful businessman or businesswoman. And, you know, who is this person?
Well, we also talk about Tudor Dixon needing to reach out to Southeast Michigan. I mean, he was obviously Shane Hernandez. He was a state rep for Port Huron, ran in a district that included a lot of Macomb County communities. I know Macomb County is familiar with that name. But is it big enough to attract those Southeast Michigan Republican voters?
Yeah, and I don't know if it does or not. I mean, I get into Wayne County, Oakland County, do they know Shane Hernandez? I don't know. But I do think that of all the people that I had heard that she was considering, I think that he's probably the best pick, even if he doesn't attract independence. And I think that the only red flag here I see is that it took them so long to get to that decision. And does that speak of other decisions down the lane or down the line here? I mean, we still are. So this is August 22. We're recording this. And she really hasn't had any kind of response on the paid media to what the Democratic Governors Association is doing in dropping $4 million on her head right now. And you know, the fact the Republican Governors Association hasn't responded in kind tells me that they see better opportunities elsewhere. And maybe I'm wrong, but that's what I see. The polling would seem that the race is tight. That ARP poll showed 51-46 for Tudor Dixon losing to Gretchen Whitmer, which would see, you know, only 5 points, but didn't seem like a lot of undecideds there. I don't know if you had any thoughts on that particular poll. I saw there was another one that had Gretchen Whitmer up 51-39%. Blueprint Polling put something out last week that showed that Whitmer had a solid lead in the governor's race, 51-39%. I don't know what you make of that, John.
I think the fact that if she were under 50, she should be concerned. Obviously, any candidate, any incumbent under 50 should be concerned. The fact that she's over right now and we're not even entering, or we're 2 weeks away still from entering the what's going to be the large media saturation phase of this campaign, and given her advantage, I think she should feel pretty comfortable right now.
All right, so we're going to move to the Democratic Convention quickly, Samantha. This is where you spent your weekend here. And let's talk about a congressional race that should be pretty competitive. Carl Marlinga versus John James. What did you get a sense of when you were going around the Lansing Center?
Yeah, first thing, I am happy that I was at the Democratic Convention instead of following people around at the Woodward Dream Cruise, because I would definitely like to see some hazard pay if you wanted me to drive on Woodward last weekend. One thing that definitely I considered pretty unique about this weekend's convention is that a congressional race that they were really, really highlighting was the Carl Marlinga versus John James. So I had gone to the Women's Caucus that morning to cover to see what the energy was like Saturday morning, and Carl Marlinga was one of the first people there. This is definitely going to be a very hotly attended caucus, especially given everything going on with abortion, the Roe v. Wade overturn. So I got to talk to Carl Marlinga a bit, and you know, I realized a lot of the people surrounding him are, you know, Macomb County, like, local natives. I was talking to his social media coordinator, and she lives like two streets away from me in Harrison Township. We shop at the same Rite Aid. So that was definitely really, talking to him kind of gave me a very cozy, like a cozy energy. But then we had U.S. Senator Debbie Stabenow essentially introduce him, and she was just going ham on John James. She was like, does anyone have a house for him? Does anyone have a bedroom? He needs somewhere to stay at in the district.
You can make it up for lost time, because she certainly didn't lay a glove on him 4 years ago.
She's like, I'm not really sure if he could even point out Macomb County on a map, but it's okay.
Well, she's going after the main criticism of John James, which is that he is not from Macomb County. He doesn't live in Macomb County right now. He doesn't even live in the district. Maybe he will if he were to be elected. But that's the reason why I wanted to bring this up, is because last week the Fox News had a report that back when Carl Marlinga was in private practice, at least 10 years ago, but probably before that, he advertised on the website of his law firm that among the other services they provide, that they will represent people who are being accused of sexual assault of minors, and that during the investigation of these types of crimes, that the investigators can ask leading questions that can make you look guilty, and you should protect yourself of that by hiring them as attorneys. And so the Fox News report went after him as somebody who is protecting pedophiles and sexual assailants. And the reason I bring this up is because how often do you see people who are criticizing the hometown boy when they are not a hometown boy themselves, and then that criticism backfire on you? We can criticize Carl Marlinga if we want, because he's our guy. But who are you to say that you're going to criticize him when you don't even live here. You don't even know him. You don't even know us. I think that's the danger the John James campaign gets into when they start, if they want to capitalize on this or attempt to capitalize this, is that you're going to criticize somebody who has got deep, deep roots in Macomb County politics going back practically before I've been alive.
And I mean, how do you think this makes the people of that district feel? Like, you know, you lose a U.S. Senate race twice in a row, and then here you are like, oh, hey, like, vote for me. Third time's a charm. You know, I mean, at the same time, you know, these are people. These are people that have lived in this district for decades, have raised their families there, you know, and they have a very particular set of issues. You know, rather we are talking about Lake St. Clair, rather we are going into the more suburban areas away from the lake. We talk about the underwater infrastructure, the underground infrastructure. I mean, there is a whole set of issues there that are very specific. And I just kind of wonder, does this kind of backfire to be like, you're my third time as a charm district opportunity?
Well, I didn't see the Fox piece, but I'm real curious to see some more information about, well, how big was the law firm? You know, was it just him? I don't remember that part. Do you? Because lots of times with law firms, they'll have individual attorneys that have, you know, been successful in one or two cases that were high profile, and they see that as a revenue stream for the firm. That doesn't necessarily mean that's what Carl Marlingo worked on.
Well, and when you look at his background too, is he was a founding member of something called Care House, which provided services to child victims of criminal sexual assault. He established a sexual assault examiners program when he was serving, which allowed for prompt examinations and support services of victims for criminal sexual conduct. So he can come back if he wants to push back on this. He can talk about how he's been involved in this issue on a personal front and has been, he can basically turn the issue around if he wants to. And he has experience on this issue. And the folks in Macomb County maybe know him for having experience on this issue. Again, going back to the point of, how can you criticize this guy when you don't even really know him and you don't know us, mm-hmm. and we're offended that you think we're that stupid that we don't even know somebody who's been in our community his entire life.
Mm-hmm. I am, but simultaneously, I mean, John James obviously has a very excited following. You know, there's going to be a lot of people going out there to represent him, to kind of campaign for him. But that also brings me back to the convention. I was talking to members of kind of the youth caucus, the Young Dems, and they're like, you know, we are actually paying a heightened focus on this race, and we're going to send some of our young and hungry bodies over there for Carl Malinga. And I'm excited to see kind of how does that turn out when those young people start to go in and, you know, they have the energy, they have the stamina, and they're ready to, you know, make a tent.
And that's interesting that that happened, because there are four congressional races that are going to be competitive this cycle. And we usually don't have four. We usually have like two, maybe three. But to have four, when you have Dan Kildee and Alyssa Slotkin and then Hillary Scolten over on the west side, for them to put a focus on Carl Marlingo, I wonder if they think that they're doing so well on the others that they can play on the offense and pick up a seat that they don't necessarily had thought. Maybe they thought they could pick up, and now they do. So that's what I take away from that. I found it interesting that that was where their focus was. But let's bring in somebody who can maybe expound on that subject and others. We're going to have Lavora Barnes, chair of the Michigan Democratic Party. Joining us now on the podcast is the chair of the Michigan Democratic Party, Lavora Barnes. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
It is my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, congratulations on your convention that concluded just yesterday now. But how concerned are you that there wasn't maybe the enthusiasm we've seen in years past as far as the number of people who showed up at the Democratic convention?
It was a good-sized convention. It wasn't our biggest, of course, because, you know, none of our races were contentious. Everything had already been decided. So there wasn't a lot of work on the campaigns to turn out folks to support their specific candidate. But we felt good about the number of folks who participated both in the room and watched us on the live stream. And we're really excited about November, about our slate of candidates and about the work to be done. People were fired up. If you were in that room, you felt it. People were fired up and ready to work.
You know, I think a lot, you know, for a moment, we were looking at the Democratic Party and wondering if there was a lack of enthusiasm. I mean, obviously, you had a president. Approval ratings were not really where the party would have wanted them to be. But then you have Roe v. Wade get overturned, and that sends an absolute shockwave. How has that kind of changed the party, and how has that even changed you as a chair?
It's a perfect way to describe it, an absolute shockwave. I think, you know, many of us who've been in this business long enough have sort of worked hard for abortion rights, but believed that that Supreme Court ruling was the law of the land and would stand. And first that leaked ruling and then the actual ruling sort of sent shockwaves through all of us. To see it written down on paper and the way it was written, the words that were used, it makes us afraid, not just for the abortion rights that the Supreme Court's taken away, but for other rights that we take for granted as Americans and as Michiganders. And people are shocked by it and willing to work hard to make sure that they can protect those rights here in Michigan and frankly, all over the country. So much more enthusiasm for getting to work, much more enthusiasm for helping to support candidates, for writing checks, to knocking doors and making phone calls. All of it has ticked up after that decision. And it's, I think, it's going to continue to tick up as we get closer to the election.
On that issue, are you at all concerned about some of the questions being raised about the reproductive rights proposal, that perhaps it goes too far, that they may have given some wedge issues that actually might undercut, you know, the enthusiasm that's going on right now?
I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I feel really good about the work that's being done with that reproductive rights group and about the work that they did to build out that ballot initiative. I think, you know, our focus obviously is mostly on our candidates. And if you listen to our governor tell us over and over again that she's going to fight like hell to support and protect that right to abortion, that's the thing that we're going to continue to talk about, is that our governor and our electeds and the folks who are running as Democrats are going to protect that right, while the Republicans like Tudor Dixon will do just the opposite. We'll make sure that you don't have access to abortion and healthcare rights that you need, and make sure that, frankly, even victims of rape and incest don't have access to abortion. And it's extreme, the Tudor Dixon position is, and we're going to make sure folks know about it. And when they go to the polls, they're going to vote for the Democrats.
Now, did the Democratic Party take a policy position on the reproductive freedom ballot proposal? And if so,
did
you vote on it?
We did. We voted on it in a resolution. We supported it in a resolution of the party. Yes.
Did you all take a position on the term limits ballot proposal?
We did not. No resolution on the term limits ballot came up from, you know, our resolutions come up from the locals and then come to the state, and then no resolution on term limits came up.
How about the voting rights ballot proposal?
Yes. Yes, we endorse that as well.
Anything else as far as resolutions that you think stood out?
Those were the big ones. You know, we had a beautifully written resolution memorializing the death of our DNC member, Zahra Abbas, who was a dear friend who we lost this summer. We have resolutions about just about everything Democrats care about, from climate change to other rights, including voting rights. As always, we like to reiterate the stances of the party in our resolutions, and they are all there.
Now, I'm going to open up the can of worms that is redistricting. You know, there were a lot of people, you know, at the convention who I talked to that are still, you know, pretty upset about what this is going to mean for Black representation in both the legislature and especially U.S. Congress. I mean, for the first time, Democrats are not going to have a Black U.S. rep on the ballot, you know, to be on the ballot and to eventually become a part of Congress. I mean, how does that feel? You know, what's kind of your strategy to mend this?
It's a big deal, and it is. If I had to point to a failing of redistricting, it would be that. It would be that we were not able to preserve a district that a Black member of Congress would go to Congress from the Detroit area or from anywhere in Michigan, frankly. And it's frustrating, and it makes me angry and disappointed. And My goal going forward is to find as many Black candidates to run and represent Michiganders as we can, and eventually get us back to the point where we have Black representation in Washington, D.C. We need it. It's important. We're Michigan, after all. And it is not right that the Black folks of Michigan don't have someone they can point to as their representative in Congress, and we'll fix it.
Well, what do you tell people who come up to you and say, the Democratic Party is taking the Black vote for granted?
I remind them all the time of the hard work we do in the Black communities all over the state, you know, in Detroit and all over the state, that we are there day in, day out with offices open that are open year round, cycle to cycle, with organizers on the ground who are there cycle to cycle. And that I remind them also that the Democratic Party is the only party that cares about the issues that Black folks care about, the issues that affect our economy, the issues that affect our family, the issues that affect each and every one of us in our homes and out in the world, right? The fact that Black and brown folks are brutalized and attacked. Democrats care about it, not Republicans. And I remind them that over and over again.
In the past, we've seen a lot of enthusiasm on the progressive side. Why are we not seeing that this year? Is it because there is no contention as far as a race, a competitive race? Because otherwise, we're not seeing the same enthusiasm that we have in years past from that side.
Is enthusiasm a euphemism for anger, Kyle? They're still here. They're still part of the party. They're still very active, right? So, but what's happened is that progressive candidates have won in the Democratic Party. And now the progressives who are part of this party are supporting those Democrats and making sure they're getting elected.
The reason I mentioned that is Sam was at the Progressive Caucus and she showed me a picture. And I think we counted 10 souls in there other than the folks who were actually speaking.
Well, I don't know where the Progressive Caucus members were at that moment, maybe having breakfast, but they're still active. They're still active parts of the party. So they're still here.
And I think, you know, back to my previous question, especially looking at these congressional districts, one where there is a lot of frustrations, that would be the new 13th district, where Sri Tanadar won his election, got a lot of votes from the downriver communities. I saw him at the convention. He was going around talking to every caucus, putting himself out there. But those frustrations are still there, and I'm assuming they probably won't go away overnight. How has that been to deal with the grievances of that district?
It is not going to go away overnight. And I think that Sri, who's been part of this party for years now, running and winning and representing in the legislature, will do the work that he needs to do to make sure he's reaching out to the Black community and assuring them that he will represent their interests in Washington, D.C. That's an important part of him being a true representative of Detroit and of that community. I think the fact that he was there at this convention, willing to talk to people and answer questions and be available, is a step in the right direction. I think that we're just going to continue to encourage him to make sure he's doing the work he needs to do to support the Black community. And that means opening offices in the Black community, providing support, and hiring Black staff, frankly. I mean, we're gonna help him understand the best way to represent the Black community is to bring Black folks into his operation and make sure that they have roles that are of importance.
All right, I've got a fun group of questions here.
A fun? Okay, fun.
No, these, yeah, I know it. You're going to love this. Okay, so we have 4 congressional races, I think, in the state that are going to be competitive. You'd agree with that, wouldn't you? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right, so let's get kind of your prediction on the odds that the Democrat is going to be successful. Yeah, so this is awesome. So, like, let's say Debbie Dingell. All right, that's not a competitive race, but I think we can say there's probably pretty close to 100% chance she's going to win, right?
100, yes.
Okay, all right. All right, so now let's go to Dan Kildee. What do you think the odds are that he wins re-election?
98.
Okay. All right, Alyssa Slotkin.
98.
All right, how about Carl Marlinga?
89.
All right, And then Hillary Scolten.
95.
All right, nice.
No, I mean, when I was at the convention, that is one thing I noticed is that there was a lot of attention on that Carl Malinga, John James race. I talked to members of the youth caucus and they're like, we're ready to send our hungry bodies over.
Yep. I know a lot of people looked at that district and thought that maybe we couldn't. We can win it. We've run the numbers. We've talked to Carl. We've got a great plan. We can win this seat.
Yeah, but also that means you're going to go against the John James machine. That
again,
ran,
and you know what? We beat him before. And we can beat him again. Like John James can run, but he can't quite win. We'll get it taken care of.
Okay, now that's Congress. Now let's do where you think the Dems are going to land as far as the state Senate goes. How many seats does the Democrats win for the state Senate?
Well, we're going to get the majority, but I'm not comfortable landing on a number either on the House or the Senate. But I will tell you, we're going to get the majority in both. And when I look at the seats and the candidates who are running and the operations that both the House and Senate caucuses have put together and the work that these candidates are doing, I feel confident that we can win the House and the Senate. It's terrific.
The Democrats have typically done kind of a centralized approach when it comes to these kind of elections and kind of work together, maybe more than the Republicans have. Do you see that strategy still working in 20? You're going to adopt the same strategy, right?
We do. Our coordinated campaign, our one campaign, is a truly coordinated campaign, bottom of the ticket to the top. Our folks are out there knocking doors together, arm in arm, making sure that we're talking to all the voters. And we like to make sure that we cover as much territory as possible. So we use economies of scale to make sure that, you know, we're covering voters and then the candidates can cover other voters. And that way we get all the voters covered that need to be covered. It will continue to be a coordinated campaign and we're excited about it.
When we look at these legislative races, I mean, there's obviously Democrats that had to move for the new districts. How comfortable are you with the fact that every candidate is living where they're supposed to be living at right now?
On the Democratic side, every candidate is living where they're supposed to live. I feel like there might be at least one Republican who might not be living where he's supposed to live.
Redistricting did put people in an uncomfortable position, though, didn't it? I mean, because there were several people on both sides of the aisle that were cut out of the area that they were accustomed to running in.
This is how redistricting works, though. And I think that the big news about redistricting is that it was done by an independent panel of folks and not legislators drawing their own districts. And that independent panel clearly did not take into account where anyone lives, which is how it was supposed to be. And so, yes, the way the lines landed, some folks were drawn into districts that they might not have wanted to run in or were not the district that they currently represent and had to move. And they did move. You know, our members have had to pack up and move across lines, and some Republicans did it well as well. And then, you know, perhaps one didn't. Left a mud pit out in front of a house, but didn't actually move into it.
Okay, I wanted to ask you one more thing regarding the enthusiasm at the local level. How did the Democrats do as far as registering for those kind of bottom ticket seats, county commission seats? Have you gotten any reports on the enthusiasm on that and how you've done prior compared to years past when it comes to getting candidates?
Yeah, I don't have specific numbers. I can tell you we had a lot of enthusiasm from folks who wanted to run for county commission, a lot of great candidates running at the county commission level. And we have an aggressive school board plan and a school board project where we are working with candidates all over the state who are running for school boards because we had so much enthusiasm for people who want to step up and support what needed to happen in school systems across the state. So we're running a school board program as well. We've got enthusiasm, really, literally, bottom of the ticket to the top. People who want to make sure that they're stepping up to represent the values that we believe in. And we feel really good about the group of folks who decided to run. A lot of good teachers and former firefighters and lots of women and lots of people of color running all over the state.
I do have one more question. You've been a Democrat a long time. You've seen floor fights in conventions. You know how they can go out of control. Any advice for the Republicans going into the weekend?
If you can fix it before you get to the floor, please fix it before you get to the floor. It's always the best way. It doesn't feel like they're going to fix it before you get to the floor. So, you know, try not to let it devolve into fisticuffs.
Call in the Lansing PD. They're always there if things go sideways. Lavora Barnes, the chair of the Michigan Democratic Party, thank you so much for being on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thanks for having me on, guys. It's good to hear from all of you.
Joining us now on the podcast is Darcy McConnell. She is with the Reproductive Freedom for All campaign. Thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
All right, John, go ahead with the first question.
All right. I want to see if you've done any recent polling where you think the proposal stands. Obviously, I think we know.
I think, you know, the data shows both locally and nationally, we're, you know, between 50 and 70% support keeping reproductive freedom for all, you know, restoring what was lost under when Roe v. Wade was overturned. But, you know, like anything else, obviously, we still have to do our work to make sure that people understand I think a lot of people don't even know that Roe v. Wade was overturned, frankly. So there's some education that has to happen. And then the second step is, with it overturned, reverting to a 1931 law that criminalizes abortion, and including even in instances of rape and incest. And then, of course, you know, engendering their support for this measure.
You know, so I was covering this weekend's Democratic State Convention, and obviously the Reproductive Freedom for All team, you were around every corner of the Lansing Center. You know, and I think one thing that's interesting is that there are candidates now who are making Reproductive Freedom for All a part of their candidate literature, that when they knock on doors, they also, you know, are talking about this ballot proposal. You know, what has that been like to see this kind of new engagement with candidates and people who are out there in the competitive field?
Well, as you recall, the petition drive that is that was initiated, there were more than 730,000 signatures turned in. We had individuals from every county in the state sign the petition. And so to that extent, it does touch everyone across every walk of life. We are focused on, you know, our ballot measure. Certainly, if people want to talk about that, I think that's because their constituents are talking about that. It's a significant, important issue. And I think that people have spoken, at least preliminarily, with the signatures on the petition to say, you know, we want to protect these rights for women, to keep it between women and their doctors in Michigan.
All right. So we had John Birch on this podcast 2 weeks ago. He said that if this is adopted, unless the legislature acts, and until the legislature acts, abortion is legal up to 9 months. Is that accurate or not?
No, what this measure does is restore the rights that were lost under when Roe v. Wade was overturned. That already gave guidance about, you know, what viability translates into. What's unfortunate is that Mr. Birch, who by the way, he kind of identified himself as sort of an independent actor, not associated with the opposition campaign. So I think it's important to make that distinction. But that's not what this measure does. This measure, again, restores what was lost under Roe v. Wade. So that already gave parameters about that. So
you're saying that if we already have parameters on the books in Michigan, they would kick in as soon as this gets adopted?
Yeah, I'm saying that the guidance was given at the federal level about what's permissible. They continue to put misinformation, really hypothetical information, that's not the reality of what this ballot measure would do.
Okay, and also it says in here that abortion would be a right if this were adopted, which would mean that anybody who is pregnant, regardless of age, is entitled to an abortion, which would seem to eliminate parental consent.
Again, that's not what the measure does. That is an attempt by the opposition to mischaracterize, mislead, confuse the voters. Parents can still be involved in the decision-making process with their young adults. That does not change under this measure.
But they could, but you wouldn't need parental consent, though, to get an abortion under this measure.
Again, that doesn't change under this measure. It does not change under this measure. Parents can still be involved in that decision-making process.
Now, and you know, what are kind of some areas of this measure that make sure that you're protecting from any potential bad actors in the medical community or malpractice?
Sure. I mean, the legal requirements for doctors also doesn't change under this measure. Again, it's unfortunate that they're getting traction with misleading falsehoods. Doctors still have to meet the legal requirements. That doesn't change under this measure. It's not like, you know, you're going to go to your dentist to get a vasectomy. I mean, this still provides guidelines for what doctors have to do. That doesn't change because we're saying that these rights were lost when Roe v. Wade was overturned. We revert to a 1931 law that criminalizes abortion, even in cases of rape and incest. So we want to restore those rights that were lost.
Now, there's also a section in this that has to do with sterilization, which the other side has insinuated or has just claimed has to do with folks who are transitioning between genders. Was that an intention at all in crafting this legislation, that folks who are, you know, young people who want to, who are transitioning, that they wouldn't need to seek their parents' consent before doing something like that?
Again, the other side should be called Say Anything, because they'll say anything that's not even contained within this measure. So we know that when someone is facing pregnancy, there are all these different parts that are around reproductive rights. We just want it to be affirming of those rights. There's nothing in the language that speaks to what they are alleging about transgender. It's just prenatal care, the typical care that people need to have access to in these circumstances.
So when John Birch says this could be the most expansive abortion law in the country if this were to be adopted, you would say?
I would say John Birch and the opposition will say anything to mislead people about exactly what this proposal is. And I wish we could stop talking about John Birch and talk about what it really is. What it really is a measure to restore the rights that were lost when the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Otherwise, we revert to a 1931 law that criminalizes abortion, even in cases of rape and incest. This reaffirms the opportunity to keep the decision between women and their doctors. And, you know, as the judge said in the ruling that happened on Friday, that it would be chilling and dangerous to childbearing individuals as well as medical professionals if we revert to this 1931 law.
Moving on, in some extent, I mean, there is going to be a aggressive anti-campaign against this. So how are you kind of gearing up for, you know, what is going to be a very heated arena around this ballot measure?
Sure. So I came on board, I guess this is my third week. So, you know, we're building our team out to make sure that we can tell the story of what this is and hopefully earn the support. We hope to build on, we're working to build on the 730,000 individuals who signed a petition, read, signed, and understood, I might add, the petition in support of this measure. So that also includes, you know, outreach, traditional outreach, DOTV outreach to make sure that they're there. And of course, obviously, we've got to do what we're doing right now, right? Telling the truth about this measure make sure that others aren't making this something that it isn't.
How concerned are you about resources in this? Because it sounds like the anti side is willing to put up $15-17 million on the air to try and shoot this thing down.
We have an ambitious fundraising effort that is ongoing, and we feel confident that we will be competitive as it relates to getting our message out, you know, on the airwaves and otherwise.
So you're not concerned about being able to at least match the anti side?
Well, you know, I'm old school poll, and I, you know, you don't show your hand on everything. But so the best I can do today is to say that we feel we'll be competitive, and we're going to be ambitious in our fundraising. We have been so far.
You know, I think something that's interesting to observe about, you know, the post Roe v. Wade world is that I think for the longest time, you know, abortion, even though it was a subject that some were passionate about, it wasn't as talked about as intensely as it is now. You know, people are sharing their experiences, they're being very blunt, and, you know, even see with the governor who is, you know, tweeting about abortion access nearly every day, you know. So what has it been like to see this change in rhetoric?
Well, so I think about like so many campaigns where there was an attempt to get people to get excited about, you know, the makeup of the Supreme Court, and they would just be kind of dead on arrival. And so now it's sort of like, it's almost like, okay, well, we kind of bottomed out around that. And so here's this issue that we're faced with. And so sometimes the most extreme can be the biggest motivator. And I think when faced with the reality of losing those rights that were under Roe v. Wade, if you think about what happened with the petition drive, they, you know, it was their numbers in terms of people engaging in that process just skyrocketed once the decision came out. So initially with the threat of it, but then, boy, when it happened, that's why they were able to turn in a record number of signatures. So sometimes, you know, faced with the most dire circumstances, that can be a great motivator.
I mean, but obviously, you know, the 1931 law has been in the book since 1931. And, you know, we have been kind of speculating if Roe was something that was going to fall for, you know, I would probably say since the Trump administration. Why did it take so long for this type of measure to start?
Well, I, like I said, I just think sometimes it people don't. There have been polling data that show that, generally speaking, there's still widespread support for this. And so theory and practice are just two different things. I think once it was a reality, that became the motivator. So, and you know, you know as well as I do that sort of all politics is local, so people were faced with a whole host of other things that really were happening then, and so this just probably just didn't get the level of attention or energy until it was real.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you too is, Darcy, is do you think that Republicans may come to regret? They long wanted Roe v. Wade overturned, but if you look at the Kansas vote, if you look at what we're doing here in Michigan, what you're doing, in some parts of the country, it's going to be reproductive rights are going to be more secure than they were even with Roe v. Wade, and there's an energy level now that wasn't there before. Do you think Republicans are going to look back and say, maybe it wasn't such a great thing to overturn?
Well, honestly, first I'm going to say that this is bipartisan. There's bipartisan support for this. This mm-hmm. is not strictly a Democrat issue. There's mm-hmm. no way you get to the numbers that we talk about locally and nationally and it strictly be ID'd only as something that Democrats support. So I think, you know, we're already seeing that in terms of some people who have said that they support this measure. So, but honestly, I think that's a question for Republicans. But as it relates to our ballot proposal, I think we have support on both sides.
One last thing, kind of a technical thing. What do you think about the language? What are you hoping to see appears in the 100 words that is going to make the ballot? Again, presuming that you all have the signatures that you need.
Well, that might be a question for, but might be above my pay grade in terms of finessing the language itself. The one thing I did want to address because it's been raised is this challenge that was put forth about the petitions.
Oh yeah, you guys crammed a bunch of words together. You crammed you created a whole bunch of new words, I see.
So first of all, as I mentioned at the top, more than 730,000 people read, signed, and understood the petition. But second of all, it's the challenge has been leveled with the board, made with the Board of Canvassers. And the Board of Canvassers' role, just so we're clear, is to say whether we met the signature threshold or whether we did not. They approved the petition that was circulated. So this is, again, one of these sort of bogus challenges. Their decision, their next steps at this point is to say whether we met the number required to put this on the ballot. And we feel optimistic that they will say that because we, again, had a record number of signatures, well beyond, 300,000 plus more than that are required to get this on the ballot.
So the fact that, or if the space bar appeared to have been broken at the printer's office is really irrelevant to the fact that you guys gained the signatures, and that's all the canvassers should be looking at.
That's their job, is only to look at whether we met the threshold for signatures.
But this could present a legal issue, though, for you all, though, couldn't it?
I'm not a lawyer. Okay. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't speak to if there's any legal issue. What I can say is they made the challenge with the Board of Canvassers, and the Board of Canvassers has no role in saying whether their only role is to say whether we met the required signature amount.
You know, so when I look at critics, especially on social media, one thing that I keep on seeing is, I can't find the text. Why is it so hard for me to find the text? Why are people having such a hard time finding the text of this ballot proposal?
I don't know. It's on our website, so people can go to our website and find it on our website.
Darcy McConnell, she is a spokesperson for Reproductive Freedom for All. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you.
Samantha, last week we had Bill G. Schutte on this podcast, and he was referred in our later coverage as the likely winner of the 95th House District, and there was somebody who took umbrage to that characterization, and he's on the other end right now with us, Matt Dawson. He is the Democratic nominee in the 95th House District over in Midland County. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Believe it or not, I am a longtime listener, first-time caller. I know it's exactly what my opponent said to start last week, but I fall under that same camp.
Well, thank you for listening to the podcast. And tell our listeners why you feel like Midland County is still an opportunity for a Democratic pickup. I know that the Dems have tried it before with Sarah Schultz. She was not as successful. What do you see over there that leads you to believe that you can be victorious?
I think that there is a strong, well, there's a couple things. First of all, I think that there's a strong movement towards embracing working class blue collar ideals that I think have unfortunately been left behind by some recent politicians in the community. It's nothing against them. It's just you have limited resources. You have to figure out where you're going to place them. I personally spent about half of my life living in one of the rural communities here in Midland County, in Samford. It's an area that I still have a lot of deep roots and connections to. And I think that there is a sentiment, not so much left versus right, but wealthy class versus working class, that I hope to be able to speak to as I campaign leading up to November. And the other thing is that I think it's important to note, as you guys have mentioned, that we have the Reproductive Freedom for All bill that's going to be on, as of right now, going to be on the ballot in November. And it's going to be interesting to see how, if at all, that affects turnout and helping pro-choice candidates such as myself, especially when my opponent is so staunchly anti-abortion.
So give our listeners a little bit about your background. You're 32, from Midland, and you've worked with SkyMint. Is that right?
Yeah. I currently work with SkyMint. Before that, I was a business consultant with Deloitte. Did that for about 4 years after I graduated from Saginaw Valley State. Originally went to college to be a teacher. Did some student teaching, observational teaching, had some friends in the teaching program that graduated ahead of me and saw a lot of potential issues with our education system. And that kind of, I would say, made me reconsider my direction. And so I ended up going into business consulting, which I did until the pandemic happened. And had a lot of stuff going on in my life, lost a parent, had a lot of, you know, miles on me. I spent 4 years flying out every Monday, flying home every Friday, and decided it was time for a change and to get into something that I felt could do some good, not just for people's mental health, but their physical health and the economy of the area. And that, you know, was the cannabis industry. So that's why I'm working now.
Yeah. And that's what SkyMint is a part of, correct?
Correct. Yep. Yeah. So we're a vertically integrated company. So we actually produce our own goods and we sell it. We're one of, I think we are the largest retailer in Michigan, and one of only two or three that actually are vertically integrated.
You know, I think that's interesting because even after 2018, you know, kind of what does the new marijuana industry look like? I think that is very much a hot topic, especially on the regulatory side in Lansing. When we talk about, you know, what does the future look like for home growers or caregivers, or, you know, sometimes individuals are still being placed into the illicit market. What are kind of your thoughts on that?
I think a couple things are at play. One, we got to see what happens with any kind of federal legislation, because if that happens, what I think we're going to start seeing is a lot of out of state or interstate production and trading of goods. As of right now, you can't cross state lines with anything. So we might see an influx of products start coming in from other states, which might drive down costs for the consumers. Additionally, I think the more industry or the more companies open up and start doing their own operations, we're going to start seeing costs come down, as we've seen in other states that legalized. Lastly, I think I support caregivers. We need to be a little careful with limiting how much they can grow, because we run into situations where some people are doing home grows and then selling that to dispensaries, and those dispensaries maybe aren't doing the necessary due diligence to make sure that they're getting the highest quality product available, so that consumers are getting something that's actually going to help them with whatever medicinal needs they might need it for.
So going back here to the campaign here, this is a 58% Republican-based district. Are you hearing something on the doors that would make you feel like, gosh, I actually have a chance to win this thing?
I think that there's an openness to a politician who's actually dedicated to representing the average citizen. I think that there's a strong sentiment that both parties have kind of left behind a solid base of working class individuals, which does make up a large portion of our community, especially in the rural areas. And so I think, you know, I'm kind of trying to tap into and mimic some of what I'm seeing of like a John Fetterman, who is a Democrat that I think has shown the Democratic Party that they need to do a better job of reconnecting with that rural and working class base that I think some of them have felt left behind, especially over the last 20 years.
You know, I think some things that you do kind of see in the districts is, you know, constituents that are a little bit, you know, off-put, that are kind of off-putted by the Trumpism era. They're off-put by the, you know, the Trump rhetoric. And I mean, that is something that you are seeing with a lot of the big ticket candidates for the Republican Party right now. Is that something that you've kind of noticed? Is just, you know, the community really trying to stray away from that type of language?
I think that that's important. I personally subscribe to the idea of like optimistic realism, and that I try to be a realist and understand, like, I understand the odds makers would not place money on me in this campaign. And I totally understand why. I don't dispute that necessarily. But I like to campaign in a positive way. I like to highlight, you know, what we can do if we band together and work together, getting away from some of that Trumpism language of division that also has come from some people on the left. I want to try to nurture an idea of unity in this community. And that's something that's really important to me. I mean, I've lived my whole life in Midland County. I love my hometown. I love Midland County. That's a key part of my campaign, is that I think we need to have, like, I understand it's easy to fall into this negative mindset, but I think it's important that we try to remain optimistic wherever possible and be dedicated to actually helping and doing positive things for our community rather than sowing discontent and division.
Matt Dawson, roughly how many doors would you say you've knocked so far?
So far this campaign season, very low. I'd say like around 100. I'm just starting to ramp that up, building out my volunteer base. I'm working full time while doing this campaign. Okay. I don't have much of a staff. It's mainly just me and my volunteers. So I've been doing a lot of digital campaigning and doing a lot of focusing on a lot of outreach via social media so far.
Well, and the reason I asked is because I was curious if you could give kind of a rough percentage of how much abortion has been brought up and how much inflation has been brought up, and which one have you seen to be more of a top of mind issue?
In the city of Midland, I would say abortion is a larger issue, is something that I hear more people talking about, especially speaking with middle-aged female voters who are very concerned. I mean, honestly, I shouldn't really have a say in what they do with their bodies. And I don't think most of our, if any of our politicians should, it should be a personal choice between them, their family, and their doctors. So trying to stay out of that and hearing that from them. And then, additionally, inflation, I would say, comes up more in some of the rural areas. I know one of the popular catchphrases of my opponent is Biden inflation. He likes to hit that one a lot. And that, what I like to tell people is, you know, we can try to combat that, but that's a lot of that falls on the federal level, and we're running for a state level office. So we're slightly limited in what we can do because it has to be focused locally and on the state of Michigan, and inflation is a problem worldwide.
Matt Dawson, he is a candidate in the 95th State House District, mostly Midland County. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you guys.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. I'd like to thank Lavora Barnes for coming on a little earlier, and also Darcy McConnell and Matt Dawson. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio and Okemos. For the boss, John Rurink, and Samantha Schreiber, I'm Kyle Malin. Until next week, take care.